Hi, my name is Tim Tangerlini. I'm delighted to have this opportunity to address you as part of this DH 2020 workshop on culture analytics. I want to thank the organizers of the workshop for inviting me to share some of our research with you that we've been doing over the past 2 or 3 years, focusing on the automatic detection of things like rumors, conspiracy theories, and conspiracies in large, unlabeled social media data sets. Today's talk, Conspiracy in the Time of COVID, will talk you through some of the challenges that we faced as we developed a computational pipeline for the discovery of conspiracy narrative frameworks and how we then visualize these frameworks as network graphs. So I want to bring you back a few years to 2016 and talk a little bit about Bridgegate and Pizzagate, what I like to call a tale of two scandals. In 2016, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was implicated in a political payback operation causing 5 days of traffic chaos in New Jersey, you might remember this, in the district of one of his critics. This became known as Bridgegate. As the conspirators went to trial, WikiLeaks began leaking hacked emails from the DNC, which I'm sure you recall from the 2016 presidential elections. And these emails became the basis for stories centered on a pizza parlor, Comet Ping Pong in Washington, D.C., which became known as Pizzagate. In that story, Hillary Clinton and her campaign manager, John Podesta, were the ringleaders of a pedophile trafficking ring operating out of the pizza parlor's underground tunnel network. An interesting thing is to see how these two events were searched for on Google. And so I did a very simple Google Trends search for both Bridgegate, which of course began happening in 2013, and Pizzagate for a 4 year period. Bridgegate actually happens in September 2013. And of course, Pizzagate blows up during the week of the presidential elections in 2016. I think this is a very interesting graph for a number of reasons, which we're going to get back to later on in the presentation. In today's talk, I want to go over some basic folklore theory. I want to talk about legends, rumors, and the problem of fake news. I want to give you a model of legend structure that I've been working on for quite a while now, which derives a three-level model and includes what I call a mesoscale analysis, and we'll see why this is important. I want to show you how we develop the model and how we develop computational methods for addressing the operationalization of the model, and how we wind up at narrative frameworks as summary network graphs. In this context, we're talking about actants and their relationships, and importantly, those relationships and those actants in particular contexts. We'll come back to Pizzagate and Bridgegate and see how these methods apply to them, and then we'll move on towards a model of conspiracy and conspiracy theories. Before we talk very briefly about COVID-19 conspiracies, which we've been tracking now in Reddit and 4chan for the past 4 months. So let's move on to some basic folklore theory. Why do I want to talk about folklore? Well, folklore emerges from the productive tension between an individual and tradition. And here we should conceptualize tradition as the cultural expressive forms of the groups to which a person belongs in a collective way. When folklore circulates, it always circulates on and across social networks, and thereby it provides a forum for people to negotiate cultural ideology, which is shorthand for the norms, beliefs, and values that are all part of our everyday life. As a result of this, because of the way it circulates and the way it develops between this productive tension between individuals and tradition, folklore tends to be highly efficient at both transmitting cultural ideology and standing in as a forum for the negotiation of the contours of that ideology. Now, recall that stories are not created from whole cloth. While you might imagine inventing a story from whole cloth, that really would not be part of tradition. Stories in tradition rely on existing stories, kind of story parts. They rely on recognizable story structures. And they rely on conceptual frameworks that inform the worldview of the individuals and their broader cultural groups. So by looking at these stories, We can, in some ways, extrapolate worldview, and we can also understand story structures and how structures help us vary on top of those structures. These three features allow people to easily generate stories acceptable to their group, right? So if you've internalized these things, you can sit down with friends over a beer, well, a socially distanced beer, and you can create stories that everybody will accept. For those stories to gain a foothold in the narrative exchanges of people in those groups, because they reflect the worldview that's being negotiated between people in that group, and they also allow individuals to try to convince others to see the world as they do by telling and retelling those stories. Recall that stories have an incredible rhetorical power. We use stories to convince people of things and of our opinions. So I want to talk a little bit about legends and rumors. This is really where I got my start in the study of folklore. Legends and rumors are sources of information that thrive in low trust or low information environments. Legend, as you all know, is a short, believable, monoepisodic narrative. It's told as true, often in an informal setting and often conversationally. And so this is kind of this give and take. These are stories about, alien abductions, for example, or ghost stories that you tell around a campfire, or even stories about the haunted house down the street, or more realistically, of a murder that happened, or of other threatening groups. Legend, I've said, like all folklore, circulates on and across social networks, and it offers an efficient means for negotiating this cultural ideology, norms, beliefs, and values. Rumor, a little bit unlike legend, is really a hyperactive transmission state, right? So legend can be in an endemic state. Rumor really goes viral. It's the hyperactive transmission state or the viral state of legend. What's interesting is that rumor is often missing two key features, which I call the strategy and the resolution, which pushes action into the real world. And we're going to see how this fits in. It basically says, here's a threat. What are you going to do about it? And if you think of Ghostbusters, Ghostbusters theme song actually captures that idea very well. It asks, when ghosts appear in the neighborhood, who are you going to call? And that basically is an interesting question because the answer to that is always going to be ideological. It also means that legend and rumor are closely related to this emerging idea of fake news. Fake news is fabricated information that mimics news media content and form, but not an organizational process or intent. So you can see there's a strong rhetorical and ideological component to it. And it takes advantage of certain folkloric features, leveraging fears and strategies for confronting those fears, which are already in circulation in the communities it targets. Now, Pizzagate is a very interesting target of opportunity. It allows us to explore the folkloric dimensions of fake news, and it also allows us to interrogate the structures of legend and rumor and see how these stories can be aligned into story complexes. Now, this idea of story complexes has a long history in the study of folklore, and these story complexes can provide a comprehensive worldview, which we could link to monological thinking, which is also a key feature of conspiracy theories. Right. In this idea, you've got a grand unifying theory that explains why things are the way they are in the world. The other great thing about Pizzagate is it allows us to test our ideas at internet scale, where the internet almost gives us an opportunity for a natural experiment. Now, one of the hard things of working with folklore is that there really is no ground truth. And if there's no ground truth, it's kind of hard to evaluate your methods. Fortunately for us, when the New York Times reported about Pizzagate initially back in 2016, they produced an interesting graphic that was actually based on the drawings of Mark Lombardi, who drew these very intricate graphs of power relations in things like Watergate. In the graphic, they identified the main players, which we refer to as actants, and the relationships between those players. So in short, what they had produced was an actant relationship model, which described on some abstract level, the underlying structure of Pizzagate, who the main players were, what the relationships were between them, and the complexities of this narrative. So our challenge was, can we computationally and automatically create a representation of the Pizzagate graph that we could then validate against the New York Times graph? So from a machine learning perspective, we need to jointly estimate all of the hidden parameters of the model. The actants, and here we borrow from Algirdas Grima, who has an actant relationship model from narrative theory, the actants, people, places, and things, the context in which those actants occur, the set of relationships between actants within those contexts. And these could often be represented as hyperedges. Somebody does something to somebody with some other thing, but we can actually decompose those hyperedges into simple one-to-one actant relationship edges, right? So we might have something that would actually be a hyperedge of multiple nodes and edges, and we can decompose that into a series of tuples with just two nodes and one relationship. And then, of course, we have to estimate the edges and their labels, which is a concatenation of range of action into certain classes at a higher level of abstraction, so that we don't suffer from too many edges occluding our understanding of the narrative framework. The idea, of course, is that this narrative framework is probably generative. If you activate bits and pieces of it, you could generate a story that would fit into the larger discussion, in this case, of Pizzagate. In later work, and I'm going to show you this in the context of the COVID-19 conspiracy theories, we actually can code for potential threats in the network and in other work, which is based on Goodreads novel reviews, we can actually find the sequence of actions, which we can then test. So part of the problem, of course, was we needed to have a model of legend structure, because remember, legends and rumors are, in this idea, congruent. And then, of course, legends are brought together into complexes, and a conspiracy theory is basically a legend complex. We needed to devise a model of legend structure which would be operationalizable and would also capture the complexities of legend in performance. And so this is how we derive a three-level model, which is a little bit different from the standard two-level model, which is very common in narrative analysis. So legend structure, we borrow from Labov and Waletsky, two social linguists who have an excellent model of personal experience narrative, which was later modified by Bill Nicolaisen to fit contemporary legends and archival collections. There were six main structural components to this. Three were essential, three were non-essential. So an abstract would be a story summary. Oh, you remember what happened to John the other day? No, I don't know. Well, let me tell you. Then I'd go into the orientation, the who, where, when, which kind of sets up an inside group. This is about us. And then there's a complicating action. What happens? An evaluation. You might say, oh my God, that's horrible. That would be a commentary on the story. And then a result. Well, he was okay, despite the crowbar going through his skull, right? So what happened as a result of the complicating action? And I coda. What finally happened, actually, it turned out that he wrote a lot more very good articles after the accident. So this is a fairly standard model, but it under-theorizes this complicating action, which is really the whole point of the story. We wanted to theorize that a little bit more and realize that the complicating action is actually made up of two distinct parts. There's a threat or disruption. And the range of threats or disruptions which are allowed are limited and culturally determined, right? So not everything can be a threat. And within your group, there are certain things which are seen as threatening and certain things which are not seen as threatening. And then there's a strategy for dealing with that threat. So again, we go back to Ghostbusters. When ghosts appear in the neighborhood, who are you going to call? The answer to that is always ideological. Stories can cycle through complicating action threat and complicating action strategy multiple times. All you need to do is look at the movie The Exorcist to see that this is in fact the case. The success or failure of a strategy constitutes an ideological evaluation of the possible strategies for counteracting a threat. And so this is sort of the beginnings of a generative model of legend. Now, if you remember your third grade class on Russian formalism, you'll remember that Propp proposes this two-level model of sujet and fabula, and people, as part of their enculturation, internalize the structure of these stories, and then they produce stories that eventually, after a great deal of practice and a great deal of learning, conform to the structure. The model's really easy to apply, but unfortunately it's not useful at the level of real world data. The formalization basically fails. So we're looking for a useful model that gives us more to work with than just the connection between the deep structural level and the surface level of observed phenomena. So observed phenomena, we see a lot of stories or we hear a lot of stories, and then we know that there's some deep structural level, but it's missing all of the mesoscale, which is really the context in which these stories are produced. The other thing that is problematic with the two-level model, it assumes that all observed phenomena are complete stories, but work based on some work by John Loudon, we all know that most people do not tell complete stories. Rather, they tell story parts, and in fact, if you look at anything on social media, it's almost like you've walked into a very noisy bar and you're just table hopping and listening in on bits and pieces of conversations. You actually have to spend quite a bit of time before you understand the scope and again the framework of the underlying story. So essentially, the two-level model is reductive. It misses the importance of domain-level specificity of a story, and thereby it draws a false equivalence between domains. So we wanted to develop a third mesoscale intermediate level that binds the macroscale genre to the microscale performance. And here's where we rely on a 19th century British philosopher, known mostly for his work on Boolean logic, who said in every discourse, whether of the mind conversing with its own thoughts or of the individual in his intercourse with others, there is an assumed or expressed limit within which the subjects of its operations are confined. This mirrors some of the work by Alan Dundee, a folklorist at UC Berkeley in the early 1960s, where the domain places constraints on the range of possible allomotifs, is what he called them, that can fill motifemic slots, and you think here of something like a hero, in the narrative. So there are only certain heroes available within a certain group. That makes a lot of sense. And by adding this mesoscale of domain, we've actually formalized that. There are domain level constraints. Threats and strategies are determined by the domain. There are cultural constraints on the range of available actants and relationships between those actants. In every knowledge domain, there are limits to the range of expression. And we can formalize this as an actant relationship model. Ultimately then, from a machine learning perspective, for any domain, we want to discover the actants and the relationships. The narrative can then be derived by sequencing the actant-actant relationships and how they develop over time. And so here's the problem. We've got large-scale data with posts and logs. And within that, we know that they're actants, they're contexts in which those actants relate. And so we're trying to discover this hidden narrative framework, which actually is generative. And by activating different parts of that framework, you can actually produce posts or stories to a social media community. So what's our goal? We want to understand storytelling at very large scale, where many stories are partial and where the recordings are noisy. There's abbreviations, dialect, digressions, slang, swears, etc. And then how can we use the actant relationship model to A, understand what's being talked about in a domain, B, identify the strategies and disruptions or threats in that domain, and C, discover the underlying narrative framework for these conversations. And so to quickly give you a graphical representation of this, we can say that at the macro scale, we've got tradition and structure. This is the deep scale of something like prop. And we've got a tradition context that limits the number of possible genres. At the mesoscale, we've got information knowledge area in which the framework is anchored. And we've got a narrative framework which is based on the underlying structure. This is actants and relationships and sequence. And then finally, at the performance level, we've got stories. The performance context is a context in which the story appears. It might be social media. It might be a conversation at a bar. It might be your book group now on Zoom on a Thursday evening. And stories are instantiations of the framework in whole and actually most often just in part and might include in valuation and framing things like the abstract and coda. So we've broken this thing apart and now we can attach different machine learning approaches to it so that we can apply this model to thousands and thousands of posts on social media and derive some meaningful representation of what might be driving those conversations. So, quick summary. In any tradition group, we're going to find narrative traditions. We conform certain structural expectations. Different narratives are acceptable in different contexts. So if we're talking about alien abductions, a story of finding a good electrician makes little sense. There are cultural constraints on the admissible actants and the interactant relationships. And based on the context, these narratives can be modeled as a narrative graph, a summary graph depicting the interactions between the main actants. And so now we're back to this New York Times graph, but we have much better understanding of how and why we would want to match this. So let's quickly run through developing this model for something as innocuous as Danish witchcraft, keeping in mind, however, that thousands of Danish women were burned at the stake because of these stories. So we very quickly find a corpus of 37,000 stories, and then we, which all look like this, and we're going to try and find different actants and the relationships between them, and then code them as, in this case, for example, threats. When we do this for one story, we'll find that a witch is harming the farmers and the farm animals by stealing farm produce. And we've got on the left-hand side a pretty normal representation of what life is like on a farm. And then on the right-hand side, we've got this witch who's doing unnatural things. She's using powers and controlling animals to harm the farm, and ultimately the workers repel her. If we do this over thousands and thousands of stories, we actually come up with a narrative framework that looks more like this, that has multiple other actants and other domains of interaction, like the minister and the minister's wife, and the fight between cunning folk and ministers in 19th century Denmark. If we understand the connections, we can start to see that, for example, there's one domain of farm work, there's another domain of witches, and some of the actants align between these two domains. If we keep adding things, we find that there's a domain of ministers and cunning folk all working against witches. And then we also find this interesting domain of the minister's wife. And then we find this interesting domain of Satan. And then finally, we find a domain of manor lords. And if we project that all together, we see that these are all aligned and it creates a comprehensive worldview where pretty much everywhere you look in the landscape, there are forces of evil, in this case related to Satan, trying to undermine your farming activities. So this method then allows us to discover the main actants, the main threats, and the main strategies that people use. In this case, shoot the witch, deal with it yourself, contact a cunning person, which is a local solution, or contact the priest, which is an institutional solution. And then there's a debate going on as to whether you should have a local solution or deal with it yourself or contact the priest. And some of the stories against contacting the priest, of course, suggest that the priest is married to a woman who is in league with the devil. So one of the great things about having this huge aggregated narrative framework for witch stories derived from a corpus of 37,000 Danish witch stories is we can generate a story ourselves that will fit into 19th century legend tradition. We can also identify when there are changes in threat agents, objects of threats, or strategies. And because we know who told the story and where they lived, we can correlate this to class of narrators, say, for example, unemployed young male farmhands versus the wives of millers, or correlate this to political and church-based profiles of the parishes where these people live. So this is a good validation of the method itself. And since it's historical and we can test some of these things against political and economic developments, it actually suggests that we're on the right path. So now let's get back to Pizzagate and Bridgegate, which will bring us towards a model of conspiracy theory. Now, Pizzagate and Bridgegate are both embedded in the well-known domain of American politics and rely on the narrative of the political cover-up. And if you've watched any detective shows, which certainly I've been doing during this COVID stay-at-home situation, we know that they almost always have what we call a wall of crazy. And so here's the wall of crazy for all entities in Pizzagate derived from a Reddit corpus. And so we see this wall of crazy, and it looks really crazy, and it looks very complicated. And you think, oh, that's nuts. And this is the wall of crazy for a conspiracy theory. What I think is interesting is that the wall of crazy for an actual conspiracy looks like this. And so if you thought that was complex, look at this. I think partly, of course, conspiracy theory only exists in narrative. And so there's already some efficiency in the fact that it's being told as a story. Whereas a conspiracy is real life. And so the question is, maybe real life is perhaps messier. So one of our questions was, are there differences in the narrative framework graphs between a conspiracy theory and a conspiracy theory, conspiracy? So we decided to test that with Pizzagate and Bridgegate. So matching the New York Times graph, it's one of the few cases in folklore where we have some sort of ground truth, or at least something to compare results against. Recall, folklore doesn't really have ground truth. What is the definitive version of the choking Doberman? There is none. Folklore is based on variation. But if we've got some external truth to verify against, then maybe we can validate our methods. If we apply our methods, really the question then was, can we find the actants and relationships that organic AI, in other words, the New York Times reporter, were able to find? And are there things that they missed? So here are some examples of posts and discussions that we find in the Reddit thing. And you can see that they're noisy and messy, and they're not immediately intelligible. And so you can't really do random sampling. You have to kind of bring this all together. And then you have to recognize that some actants may not be activated that much. They may be brought in, but without frequent mentions, they're considered peripheral. So we're going to look for the highly mentioned actants and highly mentioned relationships between them. Of course, recognizing that actants aren't always referred to by the same terms. So Hillary Clinton might be referred to as Hillary or Clinton or HC or Hillary Clinton, and it could be misspelled or spelled in multiple ways. And that leads to a great deal of noise and difficulty. We get a lot of very complex statements. So the spark was the cache of emails stolen from John Podesta, who is the chair of Clinton's campaign. And so you see a complex sentence like that actually can be decomposed into a series of tuples that we use as edges between actants. So emails and Podesta are two actants, and stolen is the relationship. We then also find out that each actant has a different role in different contexts. So if we think of Hillary Clinton, who we put together in a context grouping, what we call a supernode. So Hillary Clinton is a supernode, but she has many subnodes. She's the Hillary Clinton in Democratic politics. She's the Hillary Clinton and Clinton Foundation and fundraising. She's the Hillary Clinton who goes to casual dining spots. She's the Hillary Clinton who has groups of friends. She's the Hillary Clinton who actually sends emails, which are stolen by WikiLeaks. And she's the Hillary Clinton who's involved in satanic ritual cannibalistic pedophilia. So we want to determine the context-dependent relationships and their main actants. And then we also recognize that these contexts create densely connected communities where there are many more edges between the actants in these communities than there are between actants in other communities. This, of course, allows us to run community detection on the supernode-subnode interaction graph and split out these different domains of interaction. Then when these domains of interaction start to get aligned, we can say, oh, that's the nucleation of a conspiracy theory, and we can explore that in greater detail. So for example, here we see some different Hillary Clinton connections in the context of, in this case, Pizzagate, James Elefantis, the Clinton Foundation, and the email leaks. Ultimately, we develop a pipeline of interlocking computational methods. Each one of these is based on time-tested methods in natural language processing and network analysis. But it does require a little bit of time to see how these different pieces fit together. Ultimately, we take articles in at number one. We take out the text data. We do some coreference resolution. We do dependency tree analysis. We extract relations. We get these headword nouns, which become seeds for actants. And then we create these contextual groupings. The contextual groupings basically become our supernodes. We use some BERT embedding to understand the potential subnodes, and we also give it a significant score assignment, say how important is this in the overall narrative space. We do some subnode labeling, which we base on TF-IDF scores, and then we delete and merge nodes, as well as using some thresholding so that we don't have a proliferation of nodes, particularly in these communities, so that they can be intelligibly analyzed. What's interesting about our work is that while we don't find cannibalism as a highly mentioned node in the corpus, which is included in the New York Times graph, we do find that Bill Clinton and the Clinton Foundation are very highly mentioned in the corpus, but completely absent from the New York Times graph. Cannibalism is probably included in the New York Times graph, not because it's a key feature of the Pizzagate thing, but rather because it really is arresting to see cannibalism in the context of Bill Clinton, of Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and Democratic politics. Bill Clinton and the Clinton Foundation, however, are linked through the WikiLeaks emails to human trafficking. And I think that's a very important part of the graph that is missing from the New York Times. I told you about our community detection. Here's what our community detection ends up giving us when we reduce and threshold all of the thousands of posts in the Reddit area that we were looking at. And you can see that we wind up with a meta-narrative area of politics, which sets sort of the background for this. We have meta-narrative stories, kind of Edgar Welch going to investigate this. The whole idea of talking about Pizzagate in a Pizzagate conversation is kind of interesting because the conspiracy theorists are well aware of what they're doing. That is to say, they're discerning, discovering, outlining a conspiracy theory. And then we see the actual main core of Pizzagate, which I've outlined here in red, which is WikiLeaks, Hillary Clinton, the Podestas, child sex trafficking, Satanism, Comet Ping Pong, the restaurant, and James Elefantis. If we turn on the thresholding, this becomes even less populated, and much clearer to see the different aspects of this conspiracy theory. We also get more stuff than the New York Times. We see a connection between Obama and the WikiLeaks. We see that Alefantis, for example, removes some of his posts from Instagram and also sets his account to private. And then we also see that actants and relationships are activated. They either become emphasized or de-emphasized by their aggregate appearance weights. And we can see that change in the population of the communities. Here's some close-ups of the things that we follow. We see that John Podesta follows Satanism. Tony Podesta has weird art, which uses a secret code language, which combines references to pedophilia and is also considered promoting acting pedophilia. So that's a fairly well-labeled set of relationships. Recall in the New York Times graph, the relationships weren't labeled. And then we also see this closer again. And if you want to learn even more about the Podestas, we can generate these ego networks that are focused exactly on the Podestas, which is not possible with the New York Times approach. So what we've done is we've given you a high-level abstraction, but like the macroscope that Kati Berner talks about in her plug-and-play macroscopes paper in the CACM, we're able to drill down to these different levels of analysis, and at each level, we learn something about this complex narrative space. How does that compare to an actual conspiracy? Bridgegate, what does it look like when it's modeled with our methods? Which actants and actant relationships can we discover? Is there a narrative that coalesces quickly, or does it emerge over time? What we find is that the conspiracy actually takes a very, very long time to emerge, whereas Pizzagate was stable a month out from the first post in Pizzagate forums. Bridgegate is actually still going on and just became more complicated because Bill Stepien, one of the main actors in Bridgegate, has just become Trump's main campaign manager for 2020. On the left, you see the New York Times graph, and on the right, you see what happens when we do our automated extraction. Our labels are a little bit different than theirs, but I've deliberately colored the two graphs and laid them out so that you can see that we're actually are doing a very good job of matching the New York Times graph. We also can focus on individuals and see the fairly rich connections between all of the people within their ego network. Because the conspiracy is so complicated, we focus on these subgraphs. And you can see over there, Bill Stepien and his relationship to Chris Christie as his former campaign manager. We can also see Bridget Ann Kelly, who was really one of the key figures. And again, off there in the upper right, Bill Stepien and all of the different relationships between Kelly and Stepien, as well as Sokolich, Wildstein, Sampson, Chris Christie, and Bill Baroni. And that actually gives you a great deal more detail than the very complicated and partial graph that the New York Times presents. What's interesting about the Bridgegate conspiracy is that all of the actants are from one domain, New Jersey politics. All are known people. We can confirm who they are using OpenLink data. And the relationships are all contained within the domain, unlike Pizzagate, where they kind of split out over multiple domains. And the conspiracy theory relied on WikiLeaks to align those domains. The sequencing of the conspiracy emerges slowly over time. And the graph we discovered is robust to deletions. In fact, you can remove every single person in the conspiracy theory, and the graph still remains a single large connected component. Why? Well, because all of these people are so interconnected through the process of New Jersey politics. It's certainly not the case in the context of Pizzagate. What can we learn? We can find out that fictitious stories have almost no delay between the first appearance of their core actants and the relationships, and the core actants are stable and complete from the start in these conspiracy theories, which is very different from a conspiracy where things come out through the process of investigative reporting in drips and drabs. This gives us a chance to have a generative model of conspiracy theory. So if you're bored during this COVID time, you can actually start to generate your own conspiracy theories. Conspiracy theories are interesting because they cross multiple domains. Legends generally only cross two domains: Danish witchcraft, the domain of farming, and two, the domain of satanic threat. Actants in one domain who have a normal profile take on a nefarious role in a separate domain, and each of these domains is probably marked by their own corpus of threat strategy narratives. Pizzagate mixes at the very least three domains: politics, or democratic politics, casual dining, and children. The conspiracy theory is based on the interdomain edges that connect these otherwise disconnected domains, and here that's actually WikiLeaks. So if you think about it, you've got the democratic politics. That's not much of a story. That's just you're describing democratic politics. Here we're talking about food or casual dining. That too is not that much of a story. This is a little bit more of a story, right? Because this is threats to children. And then finally, all of these are linked together by WikiLeaks. And so those dotted lines bring all of these things together. If we look at it this way, when we just extracted it, each one of these domains, if you look at the far right-hand corner there, you'll see the projection from each of these domains. We have a series of disjoint networks. When we throw in WikiLeaks, however, you'll see that that actually aggregates it all together. If I take out the WikiLeaks, the graph falls apart. I throw in the WikiLeaks, the graph is all of a sudden fully connected. That's a very different type of network than the one that we described with Bridgegate, which is robust to deletion. So now I want to go on to talk about COVID-19 conspiracies. When the COVID-19 pandemic hit, because of the low information and the low trust people have in their information sources, there was a great deal of chatter on 4chan and Reddit about what was really at the basis of the pandemic. And this is where we start to see a lively production of conspiracy theories. Unlike Pizzagate, however, there's no smoking gun. There's nothing to tie domains together. And so all of the work on tying things together has to be rhetorical and done by the conspiracy theorists. So here's what we found. It's a perfect information void for the creation of conspiracy theories. And we actually refined our methods a little bit. We added a threat classifier to identify candidate threat nodes in the community graph. And I think this helps us make sense much more quickly of the narrative framework and how they're developing in the context of the structural model of legends and its relationship to conspiracy theories. So here are five phenomena that we've discovered in the COVID conspiracy theory space. We've discovered the emergence of new conspiracy theories, the alignment of newish conspiracy theories to form larger ones, the nucleation of potential conspiracy theories, an attempt to incorporate the pandemic into well-known conspiracy theories, here the incredibly capacious QAnon, and then finally, the interaction of these conspiracy theories with the news, where it turns out that, at least in our measurements, there's no lag time between conspiracy theories and the news reporting on the conspiracy theories and the conspiracy theories picking back up on the news. We did a signal processing method to check the cross-correlation between these, what we call coverage scores, and we discovered that our number was zero. So the time between things getting picked up in social media and being picked up in the news is almost simultaneous. After the pipeline is run on Reddit and 4chan, where we've harvested tens of thousands of posts, we run this community detection algorithm. We find we have 30 large interconnected communities. These communities have more than 14 nodes. The largest one is 125 nodes. We find 229 communities in total. The ones to really look at are the ones 1, 2, 3, and this constellation of communities here, 4, and then these are nucleations, and then these are probably smaller meta-narrative or support communities. One of the big conspiracy theories we find is one linking Bill Gates to 5G cell phone technology and vaccinations. The story basically goes that Bill Gates, who is connected to global vaccination programs that actually are based on faulty research and are potentially linked to either the eradication of world populations or the sterilization of world populations as part of his obsession with global population explosions, is using 5G as a way to activate the virus, therefore causing the need for a vaccination so he can promulgate this this vaccination project. And of course, 5G, given the frequency of the waves, can wreak havoc on human cells. And so you see these outlined in red. These are the threat nodes. And you can see that we're drawing from three different communities here. Another big one is the Chinese bat conspiracy theory, where it's either related to wet markets where people are eating pangolins, and it's based on sort of preposterous culinary practices in China, or it's somehow related to labs that are doing research on bats and it escaped somehow into this wet market. So all of these are components that you can use as you create a story that fits into the Chinese bat conspiracy theory, where the Chinese Communist Party was not being truthful, and they did not give out the information that was necessary for scientists to do the research to combat this this pandemic. Another one that's very large and capacious is sets up the Western governments, Europe and the world, and the West, with China and the Chinese Communist Party. And this is one that says that the virus was a bioweapon that was either deliberately or inadvertently released into the community. And we have soldiers and pulmonologists telling us that this is what happened. Another very big one, and you can see Trump's role in this one here, is that the whole thing is a hoax, and the virus is really set up to threaten Trump, but along it's part of a, remember, David Icke is a conspiracy theorist, an anti-Semite, proposing that there's a Jewish connection to this, and we see important characters like Fauci. We see the Democrats down here. We see the elites and the globalists. We see here that it's a hoax. And we also see here the whole movement, Film Your Hospital. So this is one that really has gained a huge amount of traction and may actually be starting to align with something like QAnon. So we see supporting communities like this one. This is actually a fairly large one. That questions masks, suggests that it's very similar to the flu and SARS, and then also questions the testing regimens and talks about debunked theories. So there's a lot going on in these communities, but they're starting to align and pull into connection with each other. And of course, the goal of a conspiracy theorist is to have a totalizing theory and have their theory win, right? So to take over, to be the king of all kings, or to be the one theory to dominate all the other theories. We find nucleations like this, again, related to this whole testing regime and the flu. And here, the indication is that these tests might either be defective or perhaps might really be, the coronavirus might be no different than the bird flus or the influenza and so on. And we see that, of course, in this idea of scare governments. So this is, of course, getting great traction in certain parts of particularly the United States. So in conclusion, it turns out we can devise methods to identify important actants and their interactant relationships from very, very noisy data. We can identify context-specific threats and potentially attendant strategies. We can construct a narrative framework graph that presents a multi-scale representation of the narrative space. And we can identify narrative features that might help us determine whether an emerging narrative framework has the hallmarks of a conspiracy theory. Now, I think this could be incredibly helpful as we're working in this time when people are taking real-world action on stories that are circulating on social media, so that we could recognize these, understand where they're coming from, understand their structure, and potentially, if they are harming our civil society, think of ways to interrupt or disrupt these very harmful narratives. So I won't keep you any longer. I want to say thanks to you, my very patient audience. I want to say thanks to the NSF's Institute for Pure and Applied Mathematics, the Culture Analytics Long Program that they allowed me to run for 3 years. My colleague, Vani Roy-Chowdhury in Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at UCLA. Three very talented graduate students that I'm incredibly fortunate to be able to work with, Shadi Shasavari, Pavan Holler, and Chani Wang. And then, of course, the whole Pizzagate Bridgegate team, Peter Broadwell, who's now at Stanford, Benam Shabazi, and Ehsan Ebrahimzadeh. And I thank you again for listening, and I hope you found this enjoyable.